The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We are back in action after a little bit of confusion yesterday, hurrying our way back from the annual college campout in the hopes that we'd be able to broadcast live to you on Monday. But as some of you now know, we didn't know about the time change in the United States. I guess it's a 3 weeks difference. It seems like every year there's a wider gap between when the UK changes its clocks and when the United States changes its clocks. In any event, for the next 3 weeks, we will be broadcasting at noon here in the UK, which is, of course, normal time in the United States. But for those listening outside of the U.S., it may be an hour earlier than what you're accustomed to. So hopefully, if you missed today's program because of that, you'll catch up to speed in listening to one of the podcasts as we try to alert our listeners around the world. We do have quite a faithful band of Trumpet Daily Radio Show listeners who will track us down one way or another. So it's good to be back with you, even though it's a little bit earlier than usual. We'll have to accelerate the preparation process, not just for radio, but for some of our college classes on this side of the pond as well. Well, as I mentioned, we were coming back from the Peak District. That's about 2 hours north of Edstone, right in the heart of, I guess, the Midlands region still. I guess that still would be the Midlands. But that was from Wednesday evening through to yesterday morning. We had a wonderful time, lots of conversation, fellowship, games, food, fun, hiking, all kinds of activities. And I think everyone came back refreshed and ready. I went the 5 days without my laptop. So I came back to 109 emails, most of which were not that important. So I took care of that yesterday afternoon. Got the inbox whittled down to something more reasonable. But it was nice to see the beauty of God's creation, the Peak District. A couple of years ago, we were at the Lakes District, which is even a little bit further north of where we were this year. And of course, over the last 6 years, as I noted to the students during the campout, we've been to Scotland a couple of times. We were up at Lake or Loch Lomond, I guess it's called, last year, and we were up in Scotland the very first year. We had the UK campout. That was back in 2015, and since that time, we've been to Wales on the coast, over to the west of us. We've been way down south in Cornwall, so we've seen lots and lots of this beautiful island over the past 6 years, 5.5 years, just because of the annual campout. And speaking of travel, even though a lot of the world is being discouraged from traveling right now because of the coronavirus, we'll talk about that here in just a second. But we'll talk about the subject of travel and how important it is with respect to education. This is something that I emphasized with the students a few weeks ago, and some really interesting material, at least to me, regarding the importance of traveling. And of course, because of modern conveniences and of course, the advancements of technology, more people around the world are able to travel more than ever before. And of course, that's one reason why some of these diseases are able to travel as fast as they do, because of how interconnected this world is. Well, speaking of those diseases, spreading disease, it's like my wife said this morning when we were talking about the latest Trumpet magazine, the April edition, Coronavirus in Prophecy. That's what's featured. And as my wife was saying, we should have known when we were preparing this magazine weeks ago, we should have known that this would be such a huge, huge story. It's a story that just keeps getting bigger, it seems. Now, here at the start of this segment, we'll give you some of the latest facts, and that's important, particularly if you're in the United States, where really they're making this story into something that can bludgeon Donald Trump's re-election hopes. So they're taking this and politicizing it, which is not surprising. But when you look at the facts, and really not so much even in the United States, but around the world, as you might have heard even at the top of the hour with the news, in Italy, you've got the whole country in lockdown. You've got the entire nation quarantined. They're taking the worst of it, at least in Europe. This entire nation, the death toll in Italy now is up to 463. They've had 9,000 confirmed cases. But to put the whole nation basically in quarantine, if you've seen any images of Italy, it's just like a ghost town. There are cities. Everything's shut down. This news report says all forms of gatherings in public places or sites open to the public, all of them, they're banned, including funerals, weddings, sports events, bars and restaurants have to shut down after dark, schools, museums, libraries, cinemas, they're all closed. That's just in the heart of Europe, in the south of Europe. And Italians are being encouraged to stay indoors and to not travel unless it's just absolutely urgent. And so you have that happening in Europe, and you have other nations, I think, somewhat in a panic over what might could happen. Even here in the UK, this one professor of biology at the University College of London, he said the trajectory of the epidemic in the UK is so far roughly comparable to the one in northern Italy. Well, we'll see, I suppose, in a few weeks if it's as bad. But it says here, it's also possible that a lockdown strategy similar to the one imposed in northern Italy may be adopted by the UK and other countries at some point in the future. And you've already had some large events canceled because of what might could happen. Now, in the United States, I forget the death toll. It's still relatively low, 26, 27, something like that. But just like in so many of these other nations, I think France has a top politician. The U.S., the current chief of staff, he's in self-quarantine because he came into contact with someone who had the disease or the virus. France's culture minister, that's who it is. He has it. You've heard about the Iranian officials that have died as a result of this virus. Three senior Iranian government officials have been killed by the coronavirus. And of course, this is a virus that started in Wuhan in China. China's the one that's been hit the hardest. Now, in compiling the very latest on all of these stats, I think Richard made a really fascinating point this morning. If you pull up that that screen of all the nations that have been hit by this, China, of course, having been hit the hardest, you've got China, you've got Iran, you've got Italy, and you've got Germany, although Germany hasn't been hit by it as hard directly, like Richard pointed out, it's the world's number one exporting nation. You can see the list. It's up on the YouTube stream now. The total case, that's actually an old one. Mine said 4,000 over. I wonder why that is. Anyway, that's from, if you look at the list over to the left, they have the nations that have been hit the hardest, China, Iran, Italy, and Germany. And it's just interesting that all of these nations factor into Bible prophecy in a pretty significant way. Kings of the East, the King of the South, the King of the North, and really, to this point, the UK and the United States, they haven't been hit as hard by this outbreak. And Richard was making the point, based on that prophecy in Zechariah 6, just how measured the destruction is, these horses that are unleashed And it's all according to God's purpose and plan. It is of God. It is God trying to get our attention. As I say, the latest trumpet magazine, as is generally the case, it's all over this story. And here it was prepared weeks and weeks in advance. And if you want to get God's perspective, never mind the hysteria, particularly in the U.S., but if you want to get God's perspective, you can go to the latest trumpet. Even Brent Noctegal, he had a trumpet brief he sent out last night. Again, a good balanced perspective on how it's even impacted him and his family life in Israel. He's our Jerusalem correspondent, of course. In Israel, they don't have that many cases there. 35, I guess, active cases in Israel, a nation of 8 million people. And yet, the measures that the Israeli government has taken to protect their citizens, it's pretty strict. And in a way where it's impacted Brent and his family. He wrote in the trumpet brief last night, "Nevertheless, these changes are worth considering because I can't recall a time when something so completely outside my control has impacted my family's routine, plans, thought processes, and potentially well-being." And one of the points that Brent makes here is that if this is how the world reacts to something that really isn't that serious yet, in terms of millions upon millions of deaths or casualties, if this is how they react to something like this, what happens when, as the Bible prophesies, what happens when it gets so much worse? You see images or these pictures of people in supermarkets fighting over toilet paper, of all things. Brent says, "It's worth considering further that if my life has been so impacted by 35 people out of a country of 8 million carrying a comparatively weak, though contagious virus, what would happen if coronavirus were more dangerous, more contagious, or more potent?" Well, that's exactly what Revelation 6 prophesies. That's what Zechariah 6 prophesies. In fact, in this latest Trumpet magazine, I think it was Jeremiah Jacques who had the inset article in my father's featured piece, but he talked about how that this is weakening China significantly and how that too could factor into prophecy for not just China, but for Russia and China. Jeremiah says the expanding pandemic could help shift the global power balance in line with Bible prophecy. And he talks in this little article about how that Russia and China are prophesied to come together. They're the two main players in the kings of the East, and how that the king, the top dog in this alliance, so to speak, is Vladimir Putin. He's been identified in the prophet Ezekiel's book. My father's written on that, the Prince of Rosh, and so on. But the point that Jeremiah makes is that if you look at these two, this alliance between Putin and then President Xi in China, typically analysts are out there saying it's a love affair where President Xi sort of has the upper hand because, well, there's just so many people in China. They impact the world economy so much more than Russia does. But Jeremiah says that the way that the Chinese or the way that China has been weakened is just playing into Vladimir Putin's hands. It says here, China will be weakened. He says this, no matter how many deaths will come from this, already, just looking at it economically, China has been weakened. It says this is significant because the trumpet has been expecting a decline in the power of Xi and China relative to that of his fellow strongman in Russia. So as China declines, you look at Vladimir Putin, and of course, Vladimir Putin just recently, he grabbed more power in Russia. He's there for life. Jeremiah concludes here, "The path the Wuhan coronavirus takes next could determine how soon and to what degree the power of Xi Jinping and China will be reduced. Meanwhile, Russia is virtually untouched by the disease. And Putin has just set a plan in motion designed to let him rule Russia with increasing influence over its neighboring nations for as long as he lives. The power balance in the Russia-China axis is shifting in accordance with prophecy. The power balance, here again, when you think of Zechariah 6, and you can read about that prophecy in my father's featured piece, but he says, I think I have the quote here. Yeah, it's actually here in my notes. My father wrote in the recent Trumpet, he says, God, it's about the Zechariah 6 prophecy, and my father says, God is in close control over exactly how much devastation these beings are allowed to unleash. He is not destroying indiscriminately. He is punishing the world in love and in measure to help mankind turn from the paths of destruction to a way of truth and peace. It says, God will allow the diseases and other afflictions represented by these horses, the horses of Zechariah 6, to affect mankind to precisely the degree needed to help them repent no more, no less. Now, just to focus in on the precision of these many prophecies, and going back to the point that Jeremiah made, how that the power balance, even the detail of that, between Russia and China, these two that are to come together, but the power balance needs to tip in the favor of Putin because he's the Prince of Rosh. So here is, if you go to the list of people infected, China overwhelmingly, far and away, they've taken the biggest hit by far. And then you go right down the list, and the point that Richard made, here Russia's not been touched, but Iran, they're the king of the south. Italy, it certainly had a negative impact on German trade. Now, the whole world's been impacted. You look at the wild swings in the stock market. Yesterday, it goes down something like 7 or 8%. And then, judging by some of the early signs this morning, it's probably going to bump back up several percentage points. We'll see. So everyone's been impacted. But in terms of numbers, to this point, the United States and the UK, they haven't really been hit that hard, not yet. And we know, again, from prophecy, that we're in the midst of a temporary resurgence. Now, that could come to a screeching halt pretty soon. But one would think that that resurgence is going to continue right on through the election later this year. Here's what Nancy Pelosi, she's the Speaker of the House, she's the one that, unleashed the impeachment process on President Trump a few months back. Here's what she said yesterday about the upcoming elections in November, clip one.
This election is a very important election. In my view, civilization as we know it is at stake.
If she only knew, civilization is at stake. It's all politics for her. The truth of it is, though, civilization is at stake. When you consider what is prophesied in Revelation 6, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and disease epidemics that wipe out a fourth of the earth's population. And here she and others like her, they just want to make this entirely about Donald Trump, one man. Everything hinges on the November election, the way that they see it. My father, if you want God's perspective, he says in the latest Trumpet, we are already experiencing the preliminary stages of what the Bible terms Great Tribulation, in which one-third of the populations in America and other Israelitish nations will die before being directly attacked by foreign enemies. So the future of civilization, it is at stake. And many different prophecies bear this out. But you look at the coverage, the sad and really despicable coverage in the United States of America. Everything that this president does, it's no matter. No, it does not matter if it helps, hurts, or anything in between. He is the problem. He's worse than the virus. This is one CNN commentator, Nicole Wallace. She was on one of the talk shows last night. And she said this, clip two.
I mean, we have a global pandemic and he's liar, liar, pants on fire president. Who saw this coming? I mean, this was where it was always going to land.
Right.
We were always going to need him to have more credibility on the world stage, to level with us and to be more competent than he is when our health and our family's health was on the line. And sadly, it took something like this, I think, to even shake the confidence of some members of his base.
Yeah, the base, they've been shaken. And, of course, all of these lefties in the media, they're really hopeful that there won't be any more public gatherings at Donald Trump's rallies because there's so many people that turn out for those. So they're just hoping. They're hoping and praying that this hurts Donald Trump politically. Listen to some of the hysteria yesterday. Here's Joe Scarborough on MSNBC, clip three.
Anybody that's 60 or older is in danger as this spreads, and the president is doing nothing but playing in his political sandbox while this virus continues to spread silently across America.
He hasn't done a thing. Here's the same network, Al Sharpton. Here's what he said, clip four.
We are in danger. And put the partisan politics aside for a moment, and you are on my disdain for the president. For the president to stand there with a campaign hat on and try to keep people at bay so he can play with the numbers for political reasons, while we're seeing people of all parties, all races, all economic backgrounds in jeopardy here, is as callous and immoral and sick as one can be.
That's Al Sharpton on MSNBC. Hardly any perspective right across the media landscape. No perspective, no historical references, nothing. And here again, it's coming at a time, all of these hysterical reactions, when to this point, it really hasn't affected the United States in a substantial way. Not yet anyway, like the H1N1 virus from 2009, back in Obama's first year one of his first term. This was John Brennan. John Brennan, of course, he headed up the CIA under Barack Obama. He's now a commentator at one of the networks, and he's, at least to his credit, he at least goes back and gives a little bit of perspective talking about what happened in 2009. Here's clip five.
Well, it was identified first in April of 09, and then through the next year, too, because once it subsided over the summer, it came back in the fall and the winter. And there were about 60 million Americans that were affected by H1N1 virus with about 12,000 deaths. It was different than the coronavirus right now in terms of its transmissibility as well as which demographics were affected by the virus. H1N1 affected younger, healthier adults much more seriously than the older population. So one of the things that President Obama told us, he wanted to have the science, facts, and data drive administration policies and actions. And so we had to engage very comprehensively as well as very aggressively to make sure that there was going to be a cross-the-government effort in terms of the federal government.
That's John Brennan talking about 2009, when 60 million Americans were affected by the H1N1. 60 million. And according to the CDC, 12,469 deaths as a result of H1N1 or the swine flu. 12,400 deaths. And we covered last week with you, I think it was last week or the week before, how that it took months and months before President Obama did anything, really, anything to speak of. And now, so when it is brought up, like it was there with Mr. Brennan, of course, everything that Barack Obama did was just spectacular. William Jacobson, he writes at Legal Insurrection. He actually caught the swine flu back in 2009 and gives some helpful perspective here at his blog. He said, in September 2009, I caught swine flu during the semester when I was at Cornell. For the first time, he writes, I understood how the flu could kill someone. It went straight for my lungs. I felt like someone parked a truck on my chest, and I had high fever. I was lucky to be able to get a doctor before it became really bad and was given Tamiflu and the types of inhalers people with asthma use to keep my lungs open. I needed refills on the inhalers, and I'm convinced they kept me alive. So here was someone who caught the swine flu, and he can understand why people were dying from it. It was that bad. He said this: there was a sense of panic with the swine flu, but nowhere near the hysteria we are seeing now regarding the Wuhan coronavirus. Certainly not at this early stage. It's nowhere near what it is today. And of course, what's different about today? Maybe this disease will be worse than the swine flu. We'll see. But 12, 13,000 people, some say more like 20,000. That's pretty devastating. Well, and again, if you want more perspective, and he got a lot of flack for it yesterday, the tweet that he sent out, the president, just how many tens of thousands of people, again, mostly elderly, just like with this virus, are dying just because of the common flu or some kind of a respiratory illness. A lot of people die from that every year. A world with billions of people, just the United States alone, to have 330 million people and how many known cases, how many deaths? It's astounding how much attention this gets, all so that they can go after their political opponent. It says here, I do remember then, as now, Democrats and the media tried to blame Republicans. So Obama was the president, but they tried to blame Republicans for preventing funding pandemic preparations. Does that sound familiar, he says? Jacobson says this: there's a big difference between then and now. It was not an election year. Obama was in his first year of his first term. Trump's in the fourth year of his first term. So the Wuhan media frenzy combines real panic with hyperventilated anti-Trump news coverage. So you have both. You have both. He says two things are true at the same time. Wuhan coronavirus should be taken seriously as a public health danger, and Democrats and the media are trying to weaponize it for election purposes. So they're hoping it spreads. They're hoping it hurts the president politically. They're hoping the economy tanks. Some have even stated that in months past, that the economy in the United States would tank so that President Trump could be booted out of office. Listen to John Brennan as he continued talking about Donald Trump, the president, and how he's handled this particular virus. Clip 6.
So one of the things I think we see the difference here is that Donald Trump, who throughout his entire life, he's looked at the world through a prism of how things affect his personal and financial political fortunes. And I wonder whether he's psychologically capable to put the country's well-being first and to subordinate his own interests in trying to spin things in a manner that's not going to reflect badly on him.
So he's psychologically incapable. Barack Obama was a master at dealing with epidemics, the spread of disease. Donald Trump, he's only concerned about himself. He's only concerned about his image. He's psychologically incapable of considering the country's well-being above his own. These are the media commentators in the United States. Chuck Todd went so far as to imply that China has done a better job of preventing the spread of this disease than Donald Trump. China's the one that started it. Wuhan started in Wuhan. And it's spread from there. And the only thing China was doing at the start was trying to stop the news media, was trying to stop the news of that event from spreading. They didn't care about the disease. Listen to this question, though. I forget who he's asking it of, but just the question itself. This is from an NBC commentator on Sunday, clip 7.
How uncomfortable is it that perhaps China's authoritarian ways did prevent this? Meaning, had China been a free and open society, this might have spread faster.
The authoritarian regime, because it's authoritarian, they clamp down right away and stop the disease from spreading, quite unlike the free and open society headed up by Donald Trump. The question even Here, China had a hand in spreading it because they concealed the truth. This is from that Trumpet article by Jeremiah. It says, when the outbreak started, the priority of Xi's Communist Party was not to stop the spread of the illness, but to stop the spread of news about it. The Communist Party detained journalists covering the virus, arrested citizens posting about it online, and dispatched goons to muzzle medical experts and force them to formally retract their published warnings. And yet here comes Chuck Todd on Meet the Press saying, you know, isn't it kind of uncomfortable that China's authoritarian ways did prevent this from spreading? There's your radical left-wing media in the United States of America. Well, for God's perspective, as I say, go to the latest Trumpet magazine. As Jeremiah brought out, due to China's colossal economic, political, and military power, analysts have generally seen it as the lead player in the duo, with Russia, that is, and Russia more as the junior partner. But the outbreak of the Wuhan coronavirus could weaken Xi in China and lift Putin's Russia to the helm of the most powerful of this most powerful Asian alliance. So, God's perspective. It is. It's fascinating to watch. It's fascinating even to look at the list of nations. It is. It should be shocking. Whether you're in Israel or Italy or anywhere, considering how easy. I mean, you look at what the response has been to, as Brent said, to a relatively weak virus. What happens when it's a stronger one even? What happens when it's worse than the swine flu, when it's worse than Ebola, when it's more contagious? Well, for a preview of that, you can look right into the Word of God. Revelation 6, I mentioned Zechariah 6. Of course, what Jesus himself prophesied about pestilence, famine, pestilence, and so on in the last days. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
At the top of the show, I mentioned the yearly tradition that we have with Armstrong College, the annual campout. Of course, in the U.S., that takes them to Robber's Cave, which is in southeastern Oklahoma, and it's been there every year. In the UK, the tradition's a little bit different. We call it Robber's Cave, but as I said at the start of the show, we move from one facility and location or place to the next. And this is I think, a really nice opportunity, at least for us here at Edstone, to travel across this beautiful island and to learn more about this island and its history. Travel, as Herbert Armstrong said so many times, it is an important component to your overall education. He talked in Mystery of the Ages. I won't quote everything here from the opening of Mystery of the Ages, but he talked about how he lived through most of the 20th century and he saw all these incredible advancements in technology. He saw the paradox, the alarming escalation of evils and so on. And of course, the tremendous advances in technology to go with it. He said, I've rubbed shoulders with the rich and the very poor and those in between. He's traveled, he says, over the four quarters of this globe that we call Earth. I've visited with captains of industry, emperors, kings, presidents, prime ministers. I've rubbed shoulders with and come to know the totally illiterate and poverty-stricken poor. I've seen this world firsthand at close range, as have only the very few. He saw this world close hand because of his many travels. Of course, that factored into his commission, what God commissioned him to do. But what an eventful life. Herbert Armstrong's ministry, he says, all through this long and pulsating, eventful life, I have asked myself many questions that were deep mysteries to me and remain unanswered and unexplained mysteries to the world as a whole. All through that pulsating, eventful life, he really did come to understand and know the truth about so many of life's greatest mysteries. Here is Mr. Armstrong in a message from, I think, the 1980s, where he's talking about the importance of travel. Clip 8.
Now we had come to the place here where Jesus was sending his 12 disciples. And remember that the word disciple means a student or a learner. And so they were going to school, so to speak, to him. And they traveled around with him for 3.5 years. He taught them. They traveled. And education comes by travel. Education comes by teaching. Or it doesn't make any difference whether you get it verbally or whether you get it from a book, just so you get it. And Jesus gave it to them apparently verbally, but they also had it in writing because they did study the scriptures. And you get education from travel, and you get education from experience. Now, they had traveled with him, and here he's sending them on a trip for travel and also to gain experience.
Yeah, those disciples went out to the world. They went out to the lost sheep, as you can read about in Matthew 10. And Paul came along later, and he traveled the world, the known world at that time, spreading the gospel, just like Mr. Armstrong did. We really do emphasize and stress this quite a lot at God's College because it's such a small college, not even over 100 students, and yet you have the two campuses, one in Edmond, Oklahoma, the other here at Edstone. In the middle of the UK, you've got, hopefully, God's work expanding into Jerusalem at some point. We've had several excavations over the years in Jerusalem where students have lived in that city. Our own students at this very small college that have traveled the world. It's an important part of education, as Mr. Armstrong brought out there in that clip. That was from the 1960s, I believe, not the 80s. But he said here, in his autobiography, education comes from study, from books, from lectures, from contacts, from travel, from thinking about what you see and hear and read, and from experience. Education comes from travel, from thinking about what you see. He said elsewhere, Mr. Armstrong did, travel is education. It is an experience. And experience also is education. Listen again to Mr. Armstrong here talking about how when he went to his uncle, you can read about this in the autobiography, he was asking advice Once he had decided on what field or profession to get into, and he's talking here about some of the advice that, came from his Uncle Frank, clip 9.
But he said, if you would apply yourself and if you will study and don't have to have someone prod you on, you'll get just as good an education outside of school as you can in. A lot of people think that education is something like buying a loaf of bread in the grocery store. You go in and order a loaf of bread and you drop, put down your money, you pick up the bread and you walk out with it. So you go into a college, you put down the money, you walk out, you've got a lot of education up in your mind. It doesn't come like that, you know. And my uncle said education doesn't consist of just traipsing over the doorstep of a college classroom or sitting in an armchair. But he says it consists of study and of books and of travel and of rubbing shoulders with other people and of human dealing and of thinking and a lot of things like that.
That's Herbert Armstrong from one of his sermons back in the 1980s. His Uncle Frank saying that education consists of study and of books and of travel and of rubbing shoulders with other people and of human dealing and of thinking. Mark Twain said about travel, he said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. We need it to broaden our thinking. To eliminate prejudice and bigotry and narrow-mindedness. Twain said, broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one corner of the earth all one's lifetime. See, if you get out of the little corner, it broadens your perspective. And in Mark Twain's day, of course, he was living in the 1800s. Travel back then, it was much, much more difficult than it is today. And it was expensive as well. And it took a long time. In some cases, it took weeks and weeks to get somewhere. And our modern sensibilities, you can't even imagine taking, let's say, 6 weeks out of your schedule just to get from one side of this earth to the other. Today, that can be done in less than a day, maybe 12 to 18 hours. But back in Mark Twain's day, it used to be that, well, only the rich and powerful traveled abroad. In 1855, when Mark Twain was 20, around 30,000 Americans traveled abroad. Now, the nation was much smaller then, 27 million Americans in total, but only 30,000 traveled abroad. That's about 0.1% of the overall population. I mentioned to the students, in fact, we watched the Abraham Lincoln movie based on that Team of Rivals, I believe it is, and there was a scene in there where Mrs. Lincoln asked the president, you know, when all of this is over, the Civil War is ended and so on, when you're done with your presidency, then maybe we can travel. And he mentioned how that he would have liked to go to the Holy Land, Jerusalem. He never got that opportunity. Obviously, his life was cut short by an assassin's bullet. But here was a president, the 16th president of the United States, who never traveled outside of the U.S. A president who never left the country. And as I was saying to the students recently, that means just about every single student we have at God's College has traveled more than Abraham Lincoln. Well, if you look at the way things have changed, just in the past two or three generations, you move ahead to Mr. Armstrong's lifetime. He lived through much of the 20th century, and of course, this was the century when all of these modern forms of travel came into being, and the cost since those advancements has gone down, making it more possible for human beings from all over the earth to travel all over the earth Last year, 80 million Americans traveled outside the United States. 80 million, that's in a nation of 330 million. That's quite a lot. That's about a fourth. Just in 1 year, millions and millions of Americans, and as I say, they can get across the globe in a matter of hours. This is quite unlike the time when it was so expensive, so slow, and so difficult, and so uncomfortable to travel the world. Henry Adams, I think he's a descendant of John Adams, living again in the late 1800s, I believe. He called his third journey to Europe his third or fourth attempt at education. He looked at traveling abroad as something that was very difficult, as something that he needed for his education. In Daniel Boorstin's book, The Image, this is an older book from 1961. It's mostly about the media and all of the pseudo-events that they create. So there's a lot that you can take away from it, even when you analyze the news media today. But he has a great section in there, too, about just how that travel has changed in the last few generations. He's writing this in 1961. This is something like 50, 60 years ago. But he says, formerly, travel required long planning, large expense, and great investments of time. It involved risks to health or even to live. The traveler was active. Now he has become passive. Instead of an athletic exercise, travel became a spectator sport. And when I read that, I was thinking about some of the books we've gone through with our book club. Napoleon's expedition to Northern Africa and the Middle East came to mind. This big production. He took his library with him, all of these people, animals, you name it. This was a major ordeal, taking up many, many, many months of Napoleon's life. Churchill, Winston Churchill, even going back to the turn of the 20th century when he was a young man, just before the 1900s, when he went off to Cuba or the Boer War, India, Sudan, South Africa. These were all adventures to Winston Churchill. And it was not easy. It was difficult. It took a lot of time. It took a lot of expense. It was a slow process. I remember that example in the John Adams biography by David McCullough. And he writes in there about how that John Quincy, at one point, he was just 11 years old, and John Adams, the father, was about to go across the Atlantic to work in Europe. I forget where, the Netherlands or France or somewhere. And they were trying to decide whether or not little John Quincy would go along with his father. Well, they eventually decided on him going, Mr. Adams and Abigail. And Abigail wrote little John Quincy this letter ahead of this trip. It says, "You are in possession of a natural good understanding and of spirits unbroken by adversity and untamed with care. Improve your understanding for acquiring useful knowledge and virtue, such as will render you an ornament to society, an honor to your country, and a blessing to your parents. And remember, you are accountable to your Maker for all your words and actions." So she basically was saying, just make sure you behave on this trip and that you learn from it and that you improve your understanding for acquiring useful knowledge and virtue. Travel was seen as an important part of his education. He was just 10 or 11 at the time. This wasn't just playing hooky from school. This was a learning experience. Well, as David McCullough went on to say, in the book and in his writing sense, it was just a horrendous trip. Everything that could have happened to go wrong went wrong. Everything. And so when they finally returned home, and I wish I would have gotten all the time of everything, because it was a long trip, it was a long stay, and then he gets back, and he determines when he's back to the United States that he's never going to go across the Atlantic again. He hated traveling to Europe. This was not easy. It was very difficult. Well, he eventually did go back multiple times, in fact. And again, at the encouragement of his parents. This clip by David McCullough, I've played this before. It's from 2001. And again, he's just commenting here on how much traveling was important for their education and how seriously the parents took it when they did send Quincy on these voyages. Here's clip 10.
These are the times in which a genius would wish to live. It is not in the still calm of life that great characters are formed. The habits of a vigorous mind are formed in contending with difficulties. Great necessities call out great virtues. When a mind is raised and animated by scenes that engage the heart, then those qualities which would otherwise lay dormant wake into life and form the character of a hero and a statesman. He's 12 years old.
So that's the mother this time writing to him saying, look, life is about contending with difficulties. You need this. You need this experience. You need these trips. The old English word for travel was originally the same word as travail. Borsten brings this out in his little book on the media. It used to be travail. That's the way travel was seen. You were laboring away. You were travailing. John Quincy, he was certainly travailing with his father on the way to Europe. Borsten in his book says, the traveler then was working on something. The tourist was a pleasure seeker. Tourist, as Borsten brings out in his book, that's a relatively new word. Again, he was writing his book in 1961, but it's a 20th century word. And he gives some of the history of all these travel agencies that developed in the early 20th century and how that you had the group tours and everybody got on a boat or a plane and they all went together with a tour guide. In some cases, they didn't even know where they were going. They just knew that, well, the tour guide said it was important. So they kind of follow along like sheep. And through it all, of course, you've got all of the Western conveniences at every stop along the way. The nice Western hotels. The goal, it seems, is to make the hotel, the lodging experience be just like it is in the United States or in the United Kingdom. And that, in many ways, takes away from the experience, from the travail. Now, I suppose I'm like anyone that likes the conveniences myself on trips, but it's a good point, that he makes to show just how different it is today and how everything, you think about 2 Timothy 3 and pleasure seeking, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, and then you add to that, these are things that weren't even around when Borsten wrote his book, all of the cell phones, the smart devices, where even when you are traveling out and about and experiencing or should be experiencing things, in many cases, people are just still staring down at their phones. The tourist gets to the destination without the experience of having gone. And for this reason, as Borsten brings out, you don't appreciate it. You look at the painting or the monument and think, oh, that's kind of dumb. Let's move on. Page 97 of Borsten's book, it says, now when one risks so little and experiences so little on the voyage, the experience of being there somehow becomes emptier and more trivial. When getting there was more troublesome, being there was more vivid. When getting there is fun, arriving there somehow seems not to be arriving anyplace. He says on page 109, Americans going to remote parts of the world have been transformed from travelers into tourists by the very same advances which have made travel cheap, safe, and available. So some important points, I think, to remember the next time you plan for a trip. As I told the students a few weeks ago, put a little more travail, if you can, put a little more travail into your travels and learn from it. And like Mark Twain said, broaden your horizons. If we have some time tomorrow, hopefully I can come back to this, as there's some other examples that come to mind with respect to Shakespeare, just how much his traveling really did impact his writings. That's an excellent example to look at. And there's also some really good examples to take away from the Bible as well. But that's about all that we have time for on today's program, so we'll have to pick up with that at a later time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit some feedback, you can email us at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.